I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's guest is Ben Cowan-Duar. Ben is the developer behind Cabot, a rapidly growing golf destination company, golf resort company. He started with Cabot Cape Breton up in Canada. He has since expanded with Cabot St. Lucia, Cabot Revelstoke planned in Canada as well. As well as Cabot Citrus Farms down in Florida. So we talked a lot about how Ben got his start in the industry. I think it's a unique journey. Obviously, he's a younger guy in terms of a golf developer and an interesting story on how you become one. So without further ado, here is Ben. All right, Ben, welcome on. You know, one of the busiest men in golf. Big news, obviously, in the last week with Cabot Citrus Farm, which is the old world woods, and I'm sure there's bigger and better plans for it. But talk a little bit about how World Woods came about.
Well, you know, for me, World Woods was really one of the exemplars in destination golf, if you will, sort of before we talked a lot about it. And I'd found my way there more than 20 years ago, basically just hearing about this place that had great public access golf. And obviously it opened in 1993, and Tom Fazio had done, you know, Rolling Oaks, Pine Barrens, and, you know, a circular driving range, which was extraordinarily novel at the time. And that a 9-hole par 3 before. It was a short course, I guess. It wasn't all par threes, and a 3-hole practice loop, and, you know, a 2-acre putting green. And it was sort of a, you know, a smorgasbord of golf for the public golfer, which, you know, predated Bandon. And certainly I hadn't yet thought of Cabot when I first went there, but was hugely inspired, by it. And really, I think the thing that for me, Andy, which I've heard so many times, is, it didn't feel like Florida. And, you know, people, when they said that, were really saying, you know, look, it had a lot of elevation change. It had a lot of exposed sand and, you know, had mossy oaks and, you know, and really old stately trees. And so, you know, I've long loved the place and had long hoped we could acquire it. And had tried a few times over the years, obviously unsuccessfully, until we were very thankful that we were able to buy it from the original developer, who had developed it with a grand vision 30 years ago, and able to take it forward today.
It's got to be for you a little bit different. Obviously, you've got Cabot St. Lucia in development. You've got Cabot Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, and, you know, this one though, you're taking over something with existing infrastructure. So I imagine a lot of it is kind of reimagining, updating, getting it to, you know, your standards with in terms of lodging and also the golf courses, which are, you know, as you said, I went there right after college. So it would have been early 2000s was the first time I'd been there. And a buddy of mine, we were just amazed at the golf, you know, for somebody that hadn't at that time played a lot of golf courses around the world. You go down there and you're like, God, this is a different type of golf than I'm used to seeing. And it, like you said, it was really ahead of its time.
Well, and I think, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I think the one thing that was always clear, I mean, it used to be pretty hard to get to too, right? It was a lot of sort of circuitous roads, and they've, you know, with the Suncoast Parkway now going straight up from Tampa, it's 45 minutes from the Tampa airport. And so I think it's gotten easier to get to. But as you drive in there today, it's obvious that, you know, in our model of building, you know, cottages, villas, and hotel, you know, they just never really got all the way there on. And I think Darren really was the obvious opportunity for us, Andy, which was, you know, if we could get the golf to shine like it did when you and I first saw it and build accommodation, then I think, you know, it's we love the land, love the location, and there's quite a bit of additional land that is undeveloped. But, you know, they didn't get to building the accommodation, which I think really allowed us that opportunity. I mean, I think it's existing golf, and it literally is operating golf today. And, you know, but Cape Breton, while, you know, Mike Kaiser and I brought Cabot Links, to life, you know, there had been previous iterations and, you know, a few golf course architects who had done routing plans. And similarly in St. Lucia, it was a golf development that unfortunately succumbed to the financial crisis. So, you know, I mean, I think it's hard to say that those were truly original ideas, because there were people thinking about golf there before. But, you know, I think being able to build on places that there is infrastructure and golf is certainly a lot easier than having to cobble together all the individual parcels as we did somewhat in Cape Breton.
For those that have played the courses, you know, in terms of your plans, I've seen a few things batted around the internet. Are you guys thinking more of a restoration or more of a renovation? You know, obviously, you know, both those courses aren't, I wouldn't say they're perfect in any way, but they're very good public access golf courses today. You know, what are your thoughts on those courses? Are you looking at, you know, kind of some tweaks, some major tweaks, or, you know, just trying to put them back to what they were originally?
Well, I think that's what we're really formulating the plan right now. And we haven't, you know, I'm sure there's lots of things bandied around the internet, and some of them might even be true. But since I haven't made up my mind, I know which ones are and which ones aren't, I guess. But, you know, look, I think the biggest thing that if you look at from when you first visited and when I first visited to today, what you really see is just a massive amount of tree growth, right? And certainly, you know, that has impacted everything. It's impacted the turf conditions. It's impacted the sight lines. And so, you know, I think it's clear to us that we need to, you know, to peel back some of that. I think where there's opportunities, such a beautiful site, you know, and it's, you know, part of Florida's nature coast, and you really feel it when you're out there. It feels like a real retreat to nature. And so, I want to get it to a place that it's very walkable, which, you know, in my times over the last year, or really spending a lot of time there, you rarely see anybody walk it. And it's such a great piece of ground to walk. So I think, you know, those are sort of the two obvious things that we need to do. And I think, you know, I think bring it to the market with, you know, a fresh look, and I think it's probably, I don't know where, you know, where restoration, renovation meet, but it's probably somewhere in between there.
Yeah, it's the line gets more and more blurred seemingly every day. So I never know what to call things that, you know, there's distinct changes, but it's mostly back. It's like, is it a restoration, which, you know, is a word I don't want to use ever, but it seems like the
there
one
you go. I like
fits
it. I like it.
Them.
I'm going to start quoting you and saying that. So there you go.
It's not a fun word to say, but the I haven't been, it's something that's high on my list of places to go, which is a long list, but it's high up there, is Cape Breton, and to see you know, Cabot Lakes and Cabot Cliffs. But, you know, seeing that I haven't been there, I thought, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to discuss with you is your journey as an entrepreneur, because I think that's one of the most interesting, you know, stories about, you know, this is Cabot, is seemingly, you know, you kind of worked your way into the golf space, and worked your way into one of the most envious roles in the golf space as a, you know, a large scale now golf developer. So I'd love to go back to the beginning, and, you know, could you describe a little bit, like, you know, what drove you in your mid-20s when so many people were out at the bar being idiots to attempt to build a world-class golf resort. Take us back to, you know, what got you there?
Well, you know, I think it probably started a little bit earlier than that. And I was drawing golf holes at a young age, and my mom thankfully kept binders of the golf holes, but I would, you know, watch golf. I'd read about golf. I remember, you know, you may be too young, but I remember getting up at 11:35 on in the evening, and I was allowed to as a kid, and watching the Masters highlights on CBS on Thursday and Friday, just ahead of the late show. And, you know, that was all you knew about the Masters. And I mean, I knew, you know, I was sure at, you know, 11, I knew how every putt broke, and, you know, I just loved the game, but I really loved golf courses. And so I built a golf hole, I guess when I was maybe 11 or 12 on our family farm, and I had a whole bunch of tees and my drawings on golf, you know, which I don't let any of the great architects who are mostly my friends see, were heavily inspired by, you know, Pete Dye at his most, you know, sort of do or die dramatic over water, you know, stuff, a lot of split fairways and all of those things. But so, I mean, I just loved golf, you know, from a young age, and that sort of got me into the business and at the beginning of the internet and, you know, through a golf travel business and golf marketing, I got to travel and play most all of the world's great golf courses. And so, you know, I sort of had the best job in the world, and I'd created that for myself. And that was my, you know, my early 20s. And so having rose-colored glasses on and having seen most of the world's great places, and but I'd been looking at sites for golf, as any entrepreneur with not enough money to build a golf course would be doing. And I was at a dinner in Toronto, which is, you know, is home and was home then. And I was seated next to the Minister of Tourism from Nova Scotia, who was there playing the fiddle. And I was predisposed to loving Cape Breton Island. I'd been there, and my wife's family, her grandmother's 104 and still lives in Cape Breton. So we'd been there in the summer.
God.
But
104.
He said, I know, good genes. So he said, you know, look, I've got this great site for golf. And I said, Minister, honestly, every farmer I've ever met with 200 acres thinks they've got the next great site for golf. And, you know, I guess I was 24, and, you know, he thankfully didn't think I was too much of a jerk for saying that and got the jest, but said, no, this is the real deal. And, you know, Jack Nicklaus had done a routing plan, and, you know, Graham Cook, a Canadian architect, had looked at my curds and had called it one of the great sites left for golf. So again, it wasn't my original idea at all. And the town of Inverness had really thought about golf as far back as 1969, and had a very clear vision that this site was different, that a mile of ocean frontage and then the town. And it was because there was this old coal mine that was, you know, had been dug down 300 feet and went a mile out under the ocean floor. And, you know, so it had been obviously very hard, and nobody had been able to assemble all the land. And, you know, the photos he had weren't great. They're pretty, you know, they were aerials, but you got a sense that there was a mile of sand beach and a town called Inverness that was built. And I thought, in 2004, where in the world are you going to get to build a links golf course in between a town and an ocean? You know, Dornoch at 400 years old and St. Andrews at 500 years old, you know, those towns sort of grew up around the Gulf. This was sort of the inverse. And I just thought, seemed like, you know, the greatest idea in the history of humankind. And I went and saw it on a December day, and it was a beautiful day, and the sun was shining, and I could see all these golf holes, and it was really, really a beautiful sight. And I went back with Rod Whitman 3 weeks later, and it was a less beautiful day, and the wind was whipping, and, you know, Rod said he couldn't see it because his eyes were frozen shut, which was a bit of a tough way to, you know, to start. And he was joking too, but we got through those early days. And then I had my first meeting, thinking it was such a great idea, and was told it was the worst idea by this banker that he'd ever heard. And so, you know, and so look, I mean, it was a very tough land assembly. It took me about 3 years, and I had all sorts of ideas of how I would find enough money to build it. And, you know, I called Mike, I called Mike Kaiser pretty early on after seeing it, and he was about to open Bandon Trails, and Barn Boogle had just opened, and, you know, he said he was long remote golf, but, you know, in sort of Mike's amazing way, he said, "Ben, you know, wait, you're going to be a huge success, and when you are, you won't be able to afford more land, so you've got to go get, you know, land for the second course now." And I said, "Gosh, you know, Mike, I'm, you know, pretty young. I don't have enough money to build the first course. I don't think I would need to go longer on real estate." He said, no, you got to do it. So while we were assembling all of the pieces that made up Cabot Links, we started to, you know, look to the land at Cabot Cliffs. And I think, you know, Mike, like so many people, probably thought it was a long shot that I would be able to assemble the land, which thankfully I didn't. You know, in my naivety, I didn't know it would be so hard. But I had time and a little bit of persistence. And as it became clear I would get the land, I circled back to Mike because there was really no one else. I mean, everybody else, when I'd talk about plans of walking only and Lynx Golf, you know, they'd had visions of cart paths and, you know, green checkerboard fairways. So, you know, Mike, none of that stuff. Obviously, he's like, "Well, of course it's walking only. Like, you know, what idiot would do anything else? He wouldn't have said that." But, you know, basically, his tone would have. And so, you know, I think he just got everything I was sort of envisioning. And look, I mean, who better? I mean, aside from having done Bandon and you know, sort of the obvious, the father of remote destination golf, he really. You know, he really was just an amazing exemplar and you know, a wonderful, you know, friend, partner, teacher, all of the things you could ever hope for. So if I am in an enviable position today, it's a lot of dumb luck and more Mike Kaiser than anything else.
Yeah, I think you're downplaying yourself. You know, it's something that resonates with me is the people. I used to work for a tech startup that was funded by Marc Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, who are, you know, renowned in the tech community, you know, arguably the most successful venture capital fund in the world. And Ben Horowitz gave a talk at our office one day. And, you know, he told our group that they don't invest in any idea that at least one of their partners doesn't say is the worst idea in the world. Because if everybody says it's a great idea, somebody's tried and failed. So it's interesting because that's something that I think is smart. When I think back to me starting the Fried Egg, I was a horrible writer, horrible public speaker, and I started a business that centered around that. That was a dumb idea. Most people would say that's idiotic. But it takes, you know, that's what it takes to start something and do something different. I'd love to go back a little bit and talk about the land. So you hear about this land, you go to the land, you see it, you bring Rod Whitman out. Who owned the land? Were there different owners of different parcels? How did you put it together? And were there any, you know, any crazy stories? Like, who were the people that owned this land? Obviously, it's an old mining town. There had to be some interesting dealings in that process.
Well, I mean, you know, look, there were an awful lot of land transactions in between Lynx and Cliffs. And, you know, I think there's more than 40 parcels of land that we acquired. But I think the thing, you know, again, back to the idea of golf not being an original one of mine in Inverness, the thing that was amazing on that first day, Andy, was I went and I was met by a group of men and, you know, who had really fostered this dream. And again, when they had been told it was insane, it would never work, a golf course would never work, you know, they were told to build a 3-star golf course. I didn't really know what that meant, but, you know, like they sort of had, you know, they'd been through the ringer and they'd had their hopes, you know, rise and fall so many times. And these were all volunteers in the community. It was, you know, the dentist in town, the superintendent of education, a principal, you know, just people who had grown up in their community. And you can imagine a vibrant mining community 100 years ago that had a population far greater than the town, you know, was when I arrived there, that it sort of lost its economic engine, you know, 50 years ago. It would have been easy to be skeptical, and particularly because they felt like they'd been on the cusp of success so many times. You know, so they were not just supportive of the vision. They had really had the vision that this could be transformative and a transformative economic engine. And I think had it not been that, it wouldn't have been possible. So they were members of the Inverness Development Association, which owned a couple of parcels. The province of Nova Scotia owned some of the land, the municipality of Inverness. And there were two businesses that owned land. And so, but, you know, it really was the bulk of it was largely controlled by this group, the Inverness Development Association, and led by these town fathers who just had a vision that they needed an economic engine. And my sort of, if I have one piece of wonderment looking back on it, you know, 17 years later, it's that we were able to assemble that ocean frontage and give, you know, Rod and then laterally Bill and Ben at Cabot Cliffs the chance to, you know, to build golf on the sea and in a wonderful community. And I think when, you know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that when Mike agreed to partner and that was announced, I think, you know, the town fathers would have thought their prayers had been answered. And then obviously the great financial crisis of 08, you know, sort of threatened to derail us, but we persisted through that and opened and had some early success and built on that with Cliffs and opened the Nest, our par three last summer, and, you know, keep trying to come up with fun things to do there.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Meridian. Now you're probably wondering what Meridian is. It is a grooming product for the other areas other than your face. It's a company that breaks the stigma and helps guys take better care of their bodies. It is a very high quality trimmer. It is it's known as the top of the line product in the space. It features a 6,000 RPM motor. I think you want faster, not slower. You want more spin in this kind of realm than you want less spin, unlike your driver. You want high RPMs here. It has a flexible ceramic blade, anti-nick shaving guard. I think that's the most important part of this, is that anti-nick technology that makes sure that you don't have any nicks and cuts in the most sensitive areas. So make a resolution here. We're still in resolution season. It's early in 2022. Be just a better groomed human being. And you can do that with Meridian. So if you go to meridiangrooming.com and use the promo code FRIEDEGG, you get a free pair of boxer briefs. So a nice little freebie. If you get their premium below the belt trimmer, you get a free pair of boxers with the code FRIEDEGG, no spaces. That's meridiangrooming.com, and the promo code is FRIEDEGG, no spaces. With, I imagine, obviously, Mike Kaiser, as you've alluded to a couple times coming on, was kind of like your high water mark or in the early, where you, okay, this is going to work. Was there a point when you were really in the process? You had already poured so much time, energy, effort into it, where the opposite was, oh, this isn't going to work, and it might have been, you know, a point where you look back so many times and think, God, if this hadn't happened or that hadn't happened, and now you laugh about it, but at the time it probably occupied your brain for weeks on end.
Yeah, I think it was every moment before Mike agreed to do it was probably the answer to that. But, you know, I mean, look, from when I saw it that first time to coming to an agreement with Mike and closing on the land, you know, it was 3 years. I mean, you know, it was 3 years of my life, and it wasn't like there were, you know, it wasn't sort of your VC thing of five or six people were saying it was a good idea, and there's one person. I mean, everybody was saying like, this is a really bad idea. And you know, and I think I had a wonderful girlfriend at the time who became my wife, and she was extraordinarily supportive and said, "Like, I think you can do it." And I have two wonderful parents who both kept telling me, "Like, you're onto something. Keep on it." And so I blame the three of them probably for everything that transpired after that. But I mean, it was a very, very, very tough 3 years, and I'd had a a relatively successful, venture as an entrepreneur in sort of the golf travel space and the golf marketing space. But I was taking every penny I was making out of that business and plowing it into this idea in Cape Breton Island. And I would say, there was, I think from an entrepreneurial standpoint, you would identify with it, as would anybody who's been through that. But I think there's a lot of fear and self-loathing. And, 17 years later, it's an overnight success. And, we get to do things like this podcast. But, in those early days, if somebody had offered me a small sum of money to take over the project, I probably would have said yes. I mean, I was passionate about doing it, but it's like if Mike had said, like, look, I'll buy you out of your position and I'll do it. I'm Mike Kaiser. I've done Band of Dunes. What do I need a pipsqueak from Canada to help me? I'd have said great, because I would have wanted to see the project go forward. And I think that piece people probably who haven't been on an entrepreneurial journey really miss, which is there's still a lot of, fear and self-loathing, even after you, even after you have success and after we built Links and built Cliffs. I mean, I bought an industrial service business and I was, half thinking that that would be my only foray in golf and I'd go into industrial service. And, I had a great Canadian entrepreneur. And, Mike sort of would look at me funny when I'd talk about this other business and, but he was pretty quiet and pretty patient. And this other guy said, so, you think you can build one of the best industrial service businesses in the world? And I was like, oh my goodness, no. I mean, we're number three in Atlantic Canada. And I think we might be able to get to number two. And he said, so you built two of the best golf courses in the world. And now you're happy being number three in a relatively small market. So he was probably a bit firmer with his fingers in my sternum saying, like, look, do you not love what you do? And I said, I love what I do, but it's been remarkably fun and I'm sure I couldn't get a job if I wanted to. So I'll just keep doing this.
Yeah. I mean, the thing you hit, the highs and lows, of entrepreneurship one day. I mean, even within the same day, you can be, oh, this was the greatest idea ever. And then later, like an hour and a half later, you can be like, if somebody offered me $500, I'd get rid of this thing right now. It's unbelievable, the swings of emotion that can happen in such short periods of time. And I'm sure, like, it probably takes years off your life. With Rod Whitman, obviously, he's got quite a resume, before doing Cabot Links, but for Americans, they might not be familiar with Rod Whitman. Was he just a slam dunk hire? Obviously you're Canadian. He's a big Canadian architect. You had him out 3 weeks after. Was he always the guy that you wanted to build the first course?
Yeah, he was. And, I played golf with Rod and September 9th of 2001. And so, I guess I was 22 years old and my dad and I were playing golf through, we'd been to Banff and Jasper and I'd always wanted to see this course Rod had done called Wolf Creek, which I'd never seen. And I, I loved Pete Dye and loved his work and, I'd sought it out a lot in my travels. And so, and I knew what Pete had said about Rod and, what he told me and how much Bill talked about Rod. And so, I would have known, in a very loose term, in sort of air quotes, known, Tom Doak and Bill Coor a little bit at that point. But, I was really focused on Rod and I think, it was the quality of his work was so good. And, and you listen to Bill and Ben talk about his contributions, whether it was to Friar's Head or any number of other projects, or Pete talk about, what he had done at, Austin Country Club or onward. And so, I sort of knew there was something special and Rod is, one of the wonderful characters you get to meet, but but very quiet and, you know, the absolute opposite of a promoter. And, you know, and look, I think in, there's lots of great golf architects who are great promoters and lots of, you know, promoters who aren't great golf architects. And, you know, and Rod was just a great golf course builder who really didn't focus on selling himself. And we've worked together on a number of projects now, and it's just one of the great joys of my life. But in both standing on Cabot Links, I only thought of him, and standing on Cabot Revelstoke, I called him from the site the first day I was there, about 2 hours in, and I said, I've got something, you know, I want you to come look at, and like, you know, the next day. And then he's obviously built the par three for us with Dave Axlin, who he's now formed a partnership with. And Dave had been a part of building Cabot Links, Cabot Cliffs, the Nest, the par three. And, you know, Dave was down in St. Lucia in the early days. So, you know, another unbelievable character, an unbelievable piece of the, you know, sort of the fabric that you realize to be able to accomplish the things we're trying to accomplish. We needed amazing people like that to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm something that I'm interested a little bit, and I've gotten more interested, been thinking about the last couple of weeks a lot, is the role of developer in creating golf architecture. Obviously, everybody that loves golf architecture likes to think of it as an art form, and I'm interested because you're the one that looks at it from a business standpoint, you know, and you have the golf architects who you hire, you know, who are creating art, and you look at other industries, right? And, you know, the best music is usually produced when the band's in a garage by themselves doing it. The best art is done by, you know, the poor artist that is in their, you know, studio apartment and wherever they are, you know, by themselves making it. And I'm interested, you know, golf architecture as an art form is really different than most, because these artists don't get to create their art forms in solitude by themselves. They do it in tangent in concert with a developer in almost every case, or a membership. So talk a little bit about your approach to working with these golf architects.
Well, I think, you know, it's a really interesting point. And I, you know, I do think, you know, Andy Warhol's, you know, line about, business is the greatest art, or something to that effect. You know, I think there's an intersection. I don't think they have to be, you know, competing forces. And I think being able to, you know, being able to look at it through a business lens, and, you know, and some people would say maybe I wasn't a very good developer in some of the decisions I made. But, you know, I think the best thing we could do was give them the biggest canvas to be able to do the art. And so rather than, you know, and I'm not saying we were right and, you know, past plans were wrong, but, you know, you might have seen a plan that had a clubhouse on the ocean, which meant you had to have an entry road, you know, come down to the ocean. And that would have meant you would have had to have golf play around the clubhouse, you know, basically behind. And I guess my view was, you know, look, there were so many wonderful places that you could draw inspiration from, where it was, if we pull all of the buildings, and, you know, that's our clubhouse and, you know, our lodge at Cabot and the villas, to the top of the property, everybody would have a view looking across the golf course out at the ocean. And if we put, you know, a building right on the beach, you know, you'd see the service trucks and the parking lot, and you play behind it, and your view would be of the ocean. But I didn't think it would be a better view. So, and I think similarly in St. Lucia, you know, we had seen plans that had where we have golf holes had homes, and any real estate developer would tell you that, you know, that was valuable land that we let Bill and Ben build 9 greens on the ocean. But I think, you know, my interest and the intersection, I hope, of the business and the art is to be able to let them build the best golf course they can. And then, you know, we can figure out a business model around that. And I think, you know, certainly I bet Rod and Bill and Ben would all wish they worked in solitude rather than with me lots of days. But I guess we've done a couple with each of them now, so they must not bother them too much. But, you know, I think what I know without a shadow of a doubt is I would not be able to route a golf course, you know, to the level that I've watched Bill Coor and Rod do it. I would not be able to do the tie-ins and you know, sort of the little subtle ripples and, you know, rumples that sort of cause so much delight. I have played an awful lot of the world's great courses and have not been accused of being shy with my opinion. So certainly there's lots of things along the way that I'll say, what about this? Or how about this? Or, you know, but I think ultimately they are the artists and they hold the brush and I marvel at it. And I think the only thing, you know, Mike told me this, we were having dinner at Pebble Beach after Links and Cliffs had opened and, you know, we both long admired Pebble and, you know, I was saying it's so funny. The process of doing it is so much more fun than I thought it would be. And I would have thought the process of like, we've got a golf course and now we get to play it. Like, you know, as a kid, I thought like, that'll be the greatest day of your life. And, you know, and Mike, as he's done so many times before, sort of, you know, said, we'll stand on the first tee and we won't play on opening day. And, you know, the joy I get from doing, it's really special to be able to do Revelstoke with Rod all these years later, to do St. Lucia with Bill and Ben. And, you know, we were down with them a month ago, but, you know, down a few months ago, Mike, Bill, Ben and I, it was just the four of us. And, you know, we're walking around at St. Lucia. And as a kid, you know, I grew up loving the Masters, as I said, and, you know, loving Ben Crenshaw and, you know, and sort of all things golf. And so it was easy, you know, in the busyness of Cabot Cliffs to forget that, you know, I was getting to build a golf course with Bill Coor, Ben Crenshaw, and Mike Kaiser. And, you know, sometimes it was, you're sort of like, you're focused on, okay, we got to get it done and we got a budget and there's all these things. And so, you know, I think walking around with Mike and Bill and Ben and May, I sort of, you know, was acutely aware of just how fortunate I've been, not just to, you know, chase a dream and get to do it every day. And, you know, I think doing what you love with people you love doing it with is the greatest luxury in one's life. And I certainly have that. But I think to watch, you know, to watch people who you may agree, and I certainly think of, we're getting to work with some of the grandmasters, not just of this generation, but of all time. And you know, so the best thing you can do is not alienate them too much and give them a good canvas to work on.
Well, Ben, you know, I appreciate the time. This is going to be part one. We'll do part two at some point, maybe part three, but we barely touched on half the topics that I wanted to talk about. And, you know, I think that, you know, I'm excited to see some of your work, excited to see all the new developments. And, you know, I think, you know, golf is in a better place because of, you know, the work that you're doing and the, you know, bringing new great golf to new destinations.
Well, it's there's nothing I can do that's more fun, and as I said, I won't get a job doing anything else anyway. So we'll keep at it, and you know, love seeing your success and cheering from the cheap seats here. So keep up the good work, and thrilled to do a second part anytime.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode was edited by the wonderful Meg Atkins. Thank you, Meg. As a quick reminder, we've got golf season ramping up. We've got the waste management. Everybody's focused on the Super Bowl. You know, you got Super Bowl picks going in. I don't know who I'm rooting for, but now is the best time to sign up for the Fried Egg newsletter. If you go to thefriedegg.com, there's a subscribe bar right there. Will Nice does a great job. It's 3 days a week. Whether you're a diehard fan, a casual fan, it is an awesome way to stay up to date with all the happenings in golf. So go to thefriedegg.com and sign up for the free newsletter. It doesn't cost you a cent.